All right, so sobriety checkpoints, driving home Saturday night and bam, flashing lights. Is that even legal?
Yeah.
Like, do they actually work? Today we're taking a deep dive into Michigan v. Sitz, a Supreme Court case that really digs into all of that.
You know, this case, what's interesting is it's not a simple yes or no about checkpoints.
Right.
It kind of gets right at like this classic problem, how do we balance keeping people safe and individual rights, you know?
Yeah.
And as we'll see, the justices had some pretty strong disagreements about where that line is.
Okay, so paint the picture for us. Like, what happened that brought this case about?
Okay, so 1990.
Okay.
Michigan's dealing with, like a lot of states, a huge drunk driving problem, right? So they're like, let's try these sobriety checkpoints. It was like a pilot program, but not everyone was happy about it. So this group of drivers, led by a guy named Sitz, they sued, said it was like violating their Fourth Amendment rights, you know, the one against unreasonable searches and seizures. And boom, their case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court.
So we've got like this clash of priorities here.
Absolutely.
The state wants to keep people safe from drunk drivers, but people also want to protect their right to privacy and not just get stopped for no reason.
Right.
So how did this program in Michigan even work?
So the Michigan State Police, they had these guidelines, right? They weren't just stopping anyone randomly. They set up these checkpoints on state roads, but get this, they stopped every single car that came through.
Every single car.
Yeah.
That's a little
It's a lot, right? And
Yeah.
that's the whole Fourth Amendment issue right there.
Yeah.
They didn't need to suspect anyone of anything to stop them. They just stopped everyone, drunk or not. That was a big part of the case.
Okay, so what happened during these stops?
So at the checkpoint, the officer would like quickly look at the driver, check for signs of drinking. Now, if they saw something fishy, then they'd take the driver aside for more tests, maybe even arrest them. But if everything seemed fine, the driver was on their way. Just a few seconds.
So it wasn't like this full-on interrogation for every single person,
No, to
just
juggle.
a quick check.
Right, exactly. And this is where it gets even more interesting. The trial court, they actually spent a lot of time looking at how effective this program was.
Okay.
But the thing is, they only had data from like one checkpoint in Michigan, and the arrest rate was really low, like 1.6%.
Wow.
Yeah, so out of every 100 cars, they only arrested like less than two drivers for DUI.
That does seem surprisingly low.
Right.
So, with the arrest rate being so low, what did the Supreme Court end up saying about whether these checkpoints were even allowed?
Yeah, so the big question the court had to wrestle with was this. Is using these checkpoints where everyone gets stopped, no suspicion needed, is that even constitutional? You know, does it violate the Fourth Amendment, the whole search and seizure thing?
Right.
It's tricky.
Yeah, it feels like they had to like weigh the state's interest in keeping everyone safe against the individual's right to not be stopped without a reason.
Exactly. And that's where this thing called the balancing test comes in.
Okay.
It's this tool the court uses to weigh the government's interest against your right to privacy. But here's the thing. They don't use this balancing test for every kind of police stop, only the ones they consider like minimally intrusive.
Wait, hold on. So if they think it's just a small intrusion, they don't even need a reason to stop you? I mean, that doesn't seem right.
I know, it's kind of strange, right? But that's the whole debate here, and this is where it gets really interesting. Most of the justices, they thought, in this case, keeping people safe from drunk drivers was more important than this small intrusion of a quick stop. But, you know, the dissenting opinions, they brought up some really important points about individual freedom and the chance of the police, you know, maybe overstepping their boundaries.
Okay, you've definitely got me hooked.
Yeah.
Let's hear what the justices on both sides had to say.
All right, so let's start with the main opinion, written by Chief Justice Rehnquist. He acknowledged straight up how bad the drunk driving problem was.
Yeah.
Remember, over 25,000 deaths a year?
Right.
He said the state had a huge interest in stopping this, right? And he argued that being stopped at a checkpoint for a minute is a tiny inconvenience compared to the potential harm it could prevent.
So basically, they were saying saving lives trumps any worries about individual rights in this case.
Yeah, pretty much. And Rehnquist made another point too. He said that figuring out how to enforce the law, you know, what techniques to use, that should be up to the officials who are accountable to the people, not the courts. Like, judges shouldn't second guess the police when it comes to safety.
I see his point, but doesn't that give the police a lot of power? I mean, what's to stop them from abusing it?
That's a great question, and it's one that the dissenting opinions really focused on, which we'll get to.
Okay.
But first, there's another thing Rehnquist said that we should unpack. He talked about this difference between what he called objective intrusion and subjective intrusion.
Okay.
Basically, he said, being scared of getting caught for drunk driving, that doesn't count in this balance. The intrusion they're talking about is the inconvenience for everyone, not just the people who might actually be breaking the law.
So, like, for most people driving through, it's seen as a small, temporary thing, whether they've had a drink or not.
Exactly. Now, let's switch gears and hear what the dissenting justices had to say. Justice Brennan, he was known for really defending individual liberties, and he wrote this strong dissent. He argued that the majority was, like, downplaying how intrusive these checkpoints really are and overstating how necessary they were to stop drunk driving.
So even though the stops were quick, he still thought they were stepping on people's rights.
Yeah. And he was really worried about the police, you know, possibly harassing people. His point was, if you don't need any reason to stop someone, you're basically letting the police stop anyone they want for any reason or even no reason at all.
Yeah.
And he was worried about where that could lead.
It does seem like a slippery slope, right? If we let this happen, what's next?
Exactly. Brennan also didn't like how the majority used that balancing test. Remember, we said it's only supposed to be used when the intrusion is super minimal. Well, Brennan said, because there was no proof the police couldn't catch drunk drivers in other ways, the focus should be on protecting individual rights.
So he thought the state hadn't really proven that these checkpoints were actually necessary.
Right. Now, we have another really interesting dissent from Justice Stevens. He zeroed in on the element of surprise, saying sobriety checkpoints are totally different from permanent ones, like at border crossings.
Interesting. I can see how knowing a checkpoint is always there, you have the choice to avoid it. It feels less intrusive than suddenly being stopped at a roadblock, especially late at night.
Exactly. With these surprise checkpoints, drivers can't avoid them. And that adds to the stress and feeling of, like, being intruded upon.
Didn't Stevens also have a problem with the lack of evidence showing that checkpoints actually cut down on drunk driving?
Absolutely. He criticized the majority for just looking at the arrest numbers from checkpoints, saying that doesn't tell the whole story. He felt they needed to look at the bigger picture. Like, were they really preventing drunk driving accidents, not just catching people who were already drunk?
So he wanted to see if they actually made the roads safer, not just increase arrests.
Right. And to make his point, he brought up data from Maryland. They had a similar checkpoint program, and they studied traffic stats in a county with checkpoints compared to one without. You know what they found?
Right.
Alcohol-related accidents actually went down more in the county without the checkpoints.
Wow, that's pretty strong evidence that maybe these checkpoints aren't as great as they seem.
It definitely makes you think. And then we have Justice Blackmun. He actually agreed with the majority about keeping the checkpoints, but he wrote a separate opinion where he highlighted how big of a problem highway deaths were. He basically emphasized how serious it was, saying drunk driving had killed more Americans than all of our wars combined.
So it's like he was trying to really drive home how serious the situation was, even though he still had some reservations about, you know, limiting individual rights.
Mm-hmm.
This case really shows how complicated it is to balance public safety and individual liberties.
It definitely does. The Supreme Court decided that sobriety checkpoints were okay, but like we've seen, the dissenting opinions bring up some big questions about whether they really work and how they might affect individual rights. And these aren't just old debates either. These are questions people are still arguing about today. So, you know, we were talking before about how the main opinion in Michigan v. Sitz basically said that the potential for saving lives from drunk driving, that's bigger than the inconvenience of those short stops at sobriety checkpoints.
Right, right. And they use that that balancing test to support their decision, saying it only works when the intrusion on individual liberty is minimal. But like we were saying, the dissenting justices, Brennan and Stevens, they weren't so sure.
Right. They thought that the majority, like, weren't really seeing how intrusive those checkpoints actually are, and that not needing individual suspicion could be a slippery slope.
Yeah, let's go back to Brennan's dissent for a second. He seemed really worried about, like, the lack of proof that these checkpoints even work in preventing drunk driving.
Absolutely. Brennan was skeptical, for sure, about whether checkpoints were the best way to tackle the problem.
Yeah.
He said the state should have had to prove that they couldn't get the same results using normal law enforcement methods that don't involve, you know, stopping everyone for no reason.
So basically his argument was, Why do these big stops if you haven't shown they're really needed?
Yeah, that's the gist of it. He felt like the state didn't do enough to prove that, and so the decision should have been more about protecting people's rights.
It sounds like he was picturing like a slippery slope, you know?
Right.
If we allow this, then what? The government can stop and question anyone without suspicion, even for a short time. Where does it end?
That's a huge question, and it's something that Justice Stevens really focused on in his dissent, too. He went even further than Brennan, saying these sobriety checkpoints were actually more intrusive than random stops that the court had said were not okay in earlier cases, like Delaware v. Prowse.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
How could that be? I mean, aren't the sobriety checkpoint stops supposed to be quick and follow a set procedure?
Well, in theory, yes. But Stevens argued that the surprise element made these checkpoints way more unsettling than a permanent checkpoint, like the ones at border crossings, you know?
So because you don't know when or where they'll be, it feels more random and intrusive, even if you're not doing anything wrong.
Exactly. You can't plan around them. And that makes you feel like you're being targeted, even if you're totally innocent.
And Stevens also pointed out that they often happen late at night, which probably makes it even more intimidating.
Right, exactly. And he argued that the police have a lot of leeway in choosing where to put these checkpoints, which could lead to, you know, profiling or targeting certain areas.
So both Brennan and Stevens, they felt like the majority didn't really get how these checkpoints actually work in the real world. It's not just about a few seconds of your time. It's the lack of predictability and the chance of, you know, random enforcement that raises some red flags about abuse of power.
Right. And Stevens also had an issue with the majority focusing only on the number of arrests made at checkpoints, as if that was enough to show they work. He argued that they should have looked at the overall effect on drunk driving accidents. Are they actually making the roads safer, not just leading to more arrests?
So, like a cost-benefit thing, are these checkpoints worth it if they're not really reducing drunk driving?
Exactly. And remember that study from Maryland we mentioned? They found that alcohol-related accidents actually decreased more in a county without checkpoints. So maybe they're not the perfect solution. Some people think they are.
It definitely makes you wonder.
Right. Now, remember Justice Blackmun, who agreed with the majority about keeping the checkpoints?
Yeah.
He also read a separate opinion where he really stressed how serious highway deaths were, saying drunk driving had killed more Americans than all of our wars put together.
It's like he wanted to make sure everyone understood how serious it was, even though he still had some concerns about, you know, limiting people's rights. It really shows how complex it is to balance public safety and individual liberties.
Absolutely. Michigan v. Sitz brings up questions that are still relevant today. Questions like, how much freedom are we willing to give up for safety? When can the government, you know, step in on personal freedoms for the sake of public safety?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we make sure the government doesn't abuse its power?
Big questions for sure.
Yeah. And it's even more interesting when you think about how things have changed since 1990. We've got ride-sharing apps now, better breathalyzers, and even the possibility of self-driving cars. These could totally change how we deal with drunk driving.
So with those options out there, wouldn't the concerns about sobriety checkpoints be even stronger today?
It's definitely something to think about. And it brings us to another important point from Michigan v. Sitz. The law isn't fixed. Court decisions are interpretations of the Constitution at a specific time. As society changes, what the court sees as a reasonable search or seizure could change too.
So even though they upheld sobriety checkpoints back then, that doesn't mean they couldn't be challenged now. New situations and technologies could make them rethink the balance between public safety and individual rights.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that makes studying cases like this so interesting.
Yeah.
They give us a way to think about these issues, but they also make us think about how those ideas work in a world that's always changing.
Yeah, we've covered a lot today, from the specifics of the case to the bigger points made by the justices. But before we wrap up, I'd love to hear your take on the bigger picture of Michigan v. Sitz. What really stands out to you?
You know, what really hits me is how this case shows that tension between individual rights and keeping everyone safe. It makes us ask some tough questions about how much freedom we're willing to give up for safety.
And it also makes you think about the possibility of the government overstepping its bounds and how important it is to protect against that, even when they say they're just trying to protect people.
Right. This case reminds us that while our rights aren't unlimited, neither is the power of the government. It's a constant back and forth, this careful balancing act that needs everyone to be aware and involved.
Yeah, that's a great point to pause for a bit. We've gone through a lot, and I'm sure our listeners need some time to think about everything and form their own opinions. But when we come back for the last part of our deep dive, we'll look at some of the ethical and social stuff that comes with Michigan v. SITS. Don't miss it. So, welcome back to the Deep Dive. We've been, you know, really getting into Michigan v. SITS, that Supreme Court case about whether those sobriety checkpoints are even allowed. We've looked at what happened in the case, the different legal arguments, and even what the dissenting justices had to say. But now I kind of want to step back, look at the bigger picture here.
Yeah, one of the things that's really interesting about Michigan v. SITS is it goes beyond just checkpoints.
Right.
It makes us think about some really basic questions about, like, what's the government's role? What about individual freedom and those compromises we make for safety?
Yeah, it's easy to say, sure, let's do things to stop drunk driving.
Mm-hmm.
But when those things might mean, like, messing with individual rights, things get a lot more complicated.
Oh, for sure. This case really makes us face some tough truths about how much freedom you can have in a society that also wants safety and order. It makes you ask, where's the line?
Right. That's the big question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where do we draw that line?
Yeah.
And who even gets to decide? It's a big responsibility.
The courts, they have a big part in figuring out what the Constitution means and setting those limits.
Mm.
But it's not just a legal question. It's a question for all of us. Like, as citizens, we've got to be part of this conversation, think about the trade-offs, and make sure our elected leaders are doing the right thing.
Michigan v. SITS is still relevant today because it forces us to think about how much we value both individual liberty
mm-hmm.
and, you know, keeping everyone safe.
Absolutely. It's like a snapshot of this debate that never really ends. It reminds us that our rights aren't absolute. They often have to be balanced against other important things, like keeping people safe.
Right. And that brings up another question. Like, even if we want to reduce drunk driving, are sobriety checkpoints really the best way? Could we do it without being so intrusive?
That's a question we should always be asking, especially as technology gets better and gives us new options. Think about things like ride sharing, those apps, and the advancements in, like, breathalyzer technology.
Mm-hmm.
There are ignition interlock devices, and we might even have self-driving cars soon.
Yeah.
These could totally change how we prevent drunk driving.
It makes you think, with all these other ways to do it, would the court decide the same way today? Would they lean more toward protecting individual freedoms if we had less intrusive ways to get the same results?
It's definitely possible. And that just shows another important thing we learned from Michigan v. SITS. Legal precedents, even though they're important, they aren't set in stone.
Right.
They're interpretations of the Constitution in a certain situation. As things change, the court's ideas about what counts as a reasonable search, that might change too.
So Michigan v. SITS isn't just some old case. It's also something we can use to think about these issues as new ones come up.
For sure. It keeps the conversation going about, you know, how much power the government should have, the importance of individual rights, and how to balance those things when they sometimes clash.
As we rack up our deep dive into Michigan v. SITS, I want to leave our listeners with one last thought. We've talked about the legal stuff and what it means for society, but what about the ethics of it all? Like, when is it okay to limit someone's freedom? Even for a good reason. What could happen, good or bad, when we do that?
Those are some really deep questions, and there aren't easy answers, but they're questions we should be asking. And really, that's what we're all about here on the Deep Dive. We might not always have clear solutions, but we want to give our listeners the knowledge and the tools to think critically about the complicated world we live in.
Well said. Until next time, keep diving deep.